This episode is brought to you by Infosys Public Services, a leader in next-generation digital solutions and consulting for the DMV. Learn more at infosyspublicservices.com/DMV. Welcome to AnvaCast, bringing news, information, and expertise to the Anva community. Here's your host, Ian Grossman. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the AnvaCast. This week, I'm welcoming back Sean Cashin, who is Anva's Director of Government Affairs. Sean, welcome back. Your second appearance on the AnvaCast.
Well, thank you, Ian. It's great to be a repeat performer on what's been an incredible foray into the webcasting community.
Ironically, we're having you back to kind of talk about the similar topic we focused on a number of months ago when we had you on to talk generally about some legislative activity. We're going to focus in on one today, which is the Real ID Modernization Act, though not really a standalone act since it was rolled into other legislation, which we'll talk about in a moment. But that's really what we want to talk to you about today, this latest development that sort of happened, took a long time, yet happened quickly at the same time when we got to the end. So take me back there, Sean. You know, we talked back in the spring about some of the things that the community was trying to accomplish through Real ID modernization efforts. There'd been a lot of conversation over the months about what might be in, what might not be in. What happened over the holidays that all of a sudden it came together and was able to get passed? Talk to us about that legislative process.
Sure, I'd be happy to, Ian. And, you know, I think it really points to the fact that, you know, hard work always really pays off. When we had gone through the exercise of really trying to educate everyone on the importance of what Real ID was and why it was so absolutely essential that it be modernized, I think that message really took root. We weren't sure of the outcome back when we took in the spring of what really a good legislative vehicle to move something like this forward would have been. I think we saw a pretty significant slowdown in the number of legislative opportunities that would have been available for something like Real ID modernization. And as the year came to a close, I think a lot of different avenues for trying to get something done rolled together for this incredible amount of momentum that was really necessary to move anything forward through the final days of the legislative session. So what really happened at the end was people were taking parts of what they had seen as really significant and essential pieces of policy or legislation and saying, this is our last opportunity to get something done. But even that was by no means assured. What we saw through the appropriations process, providing federal spending efforts for the coming year, was not really going anywhere at the time. And we thought we were really going to have to roll a lot of this discussion into the next congressional session. But what ended up happening was a huge amount of legislation was rolled into one single omnibus package that was really tallying close to 5,000 pages of policy and legislative efforts over the holidays. So Congress actually came together, they negotiated what was necessary to be moved, and Real ID modernization was actually a part of that. We continued to describe the need for our members to be able to provide services in different ways, not only as the result of Real ID being an outdated measure, but also because of COVID and everything that our members are dealing with.
Now, for a more casual listener, Sean, you mentioned the phrase an omnibus bill. Now, I'm certainly not going to make you sing. I'm just a bill on Capitol Hill. But for those that maybe, you know, aren't as intimate with, you know, those types of mechanisms, explain to our listeners what an omnibus bill really means.
Well, what it means is it's really when you combine a total tally and a number of measures. It's usually relative to the appropriations process where it's a general term that's been thrown around for instead of passing standalone measures for appropriations means you actually roll them together into a single package. And we've seen that term used in conjunction with things like minibus, which I'm doing air quotes invisibly here.
Yeah. Visuals work really great on podcasts, Sean. All our listeners are enjoying that right now.
I do my best. So they would use terms like minibus when they're describing a partial packaging of certain measures together. Omnibus is really one you kind of use that term relative to all of the relative measures being rolled into a single measure. So for this purpose, omnibus would be all of the spending measures rolled together into one. And it's really taken to the extreme because it was not just the spending measures that were rolled into this omnibus. It was everything under the sun that was under contemplation for the final days of the congressional session.
And getting it to that point, before we get into what was in the bill and wasn't, talk a bit about the different efforts that took it to get in at the end, in the sense that it was a really good example of strong partnerships and coalitions, not only with traditional stakeholders that AMVA had, but the combination of the executive branch, the legislative branch, stakeholders, private industry interests, as well as public sector interests. Paint that picture for us.
Sure. And, you know, this effort really goes back multiple years. This was the result of almost 2 years of collaboration with all stakeholders. It was not just our traditional partners, which I'd be remiss if I didn't shout out, you know, the National Governors Association, the National Conference of State Legislatures. Those are both traditional partners of AMVA because in the policy arena, we would probably do nothing without their go-ahead and their support. But we really took this to the fullest extent possible as far as education. When we started looking at this initially, we went to some non-traditional sources that really had a huge impact on the ability to really synchronize our efforts around Real ID. This included the U.S. Travel Association. This included all the people who have touch points around the Real ID credential and what it meant to their business efforts. So it was not just educating members of Congress. We combined our efforts with those associations. We went and used their platforms to try and get the message out on the importance of improving Real ID. And we really took what we learned from them in that process back to our individual members of Congress. And that momentum really built in a lot of different ways. That unified message seemed to really grab a foothold with individual members. We saw those individual members taking those discussions back to those committee offices. We saw those committee offices ending up having prolonged discussions with the executive branch, like DHS and the White House, as those conversations moved forward, to the point where when I would go up for my Capitol Hill visits, we would actually see Real ID signage outside some of those offices, which would have been nothing we would have ever imagined in the 2 years prior.
Interesting. So let's talk about what's in there. How does this new law change Real ID and what states have to do, what an individual citizen has to do, how it's being used? Give us some of the highlights.
Sure. And, you know, one of the things I always like to say when I think about what the Real ID Modernization Act does is that while it's couched in terms of Real ID, I don't think there has been a more significant piece of legislation that will transform the ability of our members to really conduct business. But in terms of what the act actually does for our members, it does a few things that are extremely important. First and foremost, it allows the Department of Homeland Security to accept electronic presentation of identity and lawful status information documentation electronically. So whereas previously you would have to visit the DMV office to present some of your materials, our hope is that the regulation process that DHS undertakes will allow for people to submit that documentation remotely. It also amends the definition of driver's licenses and identification cards to include both driver's license and IDs that are either stored or accessed via electronic means. And this includes things like the mobile or digital driver's license. It allows for the acceptance of digital photographs that are already on file with the state to be used for Real ID application purposes. And this was really a huge and monumental effort in terms of both remote processing of the Real ID credential and really for all credentials moving forward as a business process. And then there's a couple of things that it does that are external to the DMV community. It would require aircraft operators and third-party reservation entities to notify passengers of the requirements of the Real ID Act, which is really a huge lift in terms of what the educational process will be for the average consumer. I think there was a lack of understanding about what the Real ID program was and what it meant for domestic and international travel. So I think that'll go a long way. And then finally, there was the inclusion of modifying the Social Security requirements around presentation of the Social Security card. I mentioned that separately because while it's similar to what was allowed for both the identity and the lawful presence documentation that may be passed through regulation, this was kind of listed in the Real ID Modernization Act as a immediate relief measure, meaning that states could undertake the processing of a Real ID application without the Social Security card being present aside from their application. This was something that they could kind of pursue immediately. So those are the major provisions of the Real ID Modernization Act.
So when you say pursue immediately, meaning they don't have to wait for Department of Homeland Security to go through the rulemaking process.
That's correct. The other identity and legal presence documentation, the remote processing of legal presence and identity is something that requires the promulgation of regulations first. The provisions around the Social Security number were listed separately and were noted as immediate burden reduction measures. So, yes, that's something the states can pursue without waiting for the regulation.
And you just use an interesting phrase, which is the states can pursue. Talk about how all of these modernization efforts are opt-in for states to choose to do, as opposed to some of the Real ID regulations that states are required to do to be compliant.
Absolutely. And yeah, one of the main things we brought up in conversations throughout the entire process with Congress was to ensure that everything that's included in Real ID modernization that impacts the DMV community is done in a permissive manner, meaning that it's something that the states are able to pursue should they so desire. But we were absolutely clear that we did not want to impress any further mandates around the Real ID program on any of our state members. So that was something that was actually realized throughout the process. It was not easy. I think there was some times where people were looking to try and negotiate through a way to make it more restrictive. But I am glad to report that everything in Real ID Mod for our community is permissive.
So in other words, a state that's already Real ID compliant can keep the status quo, requiring their citizens and customers to do exactly what they're doing now, whether that be in in-person vetting, showing documents, recording documents, or they can opt into immediately with the Social Security card, and then eventually with the rulemaking, they can add in those other options if they want to, and they can also mix and match to the degree they want to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you did said it much more eloquently and much more straightforward than I did, but absolutely. And I also think you point to something that's very important, which is the fact that this probably and most likely will be an iterative process, meaning you may need to layer some of these improvements over time. So it is important that they be permissive so that states can continue to satisfy the program as they are now, while looking at ways to improve that process from a business standpoint and operational standpoint moving forward.
Sure. So the question with no answer, when can we expect that rulemaking from DHS?
Well, that is a good question. And I can just share that anecdotally, we're hearing different things. And I can only say that what I'm providing is speculation. I do know that there was some very important discussions around allowing DHS to kind of circumvent the usual regulatory process. In fact, that was included in the original bill, where DHS would not be required to adhere to some of the aspects of the Administrative Procedures Act that would have drawn that process out. That language was removed for political reasons through the negotiation process, but that sense of urgency has not been removed. I think Congress understands, and we have certainly reiterated, that even if this were to go into effect when it did, the day of consideration, it would still take a long time to stand up the technology requirements, the revisions to the business process that are needed to realize these efficiencies. So that sense of urgency is still there. I think DHS understands that. In conversation and not formally, we've heard that they're trying to look at different ways to try and move as quickly as possible, up to including a process similar to what we saw where they might throw out a request for information from folks and try to move immediately to an interim final rule process just to try and speed up the process.
And so you mentioned language that ended up not being in the rule. Let's talk about that for a second. Were there other provisions that as a community, maybe we've been talking about for a number of months that was in an earlier version that did not end up in the final version that we want to make sure our listeners are clear about? You might have expected X, Y, and Z, but be clear, it actually ended up not being in the final version of the legislation.
Yeah, and I thanks, Ian. I'll start with the good news first. One of the more restrictive requirements in the early versions of the bill were that you could only use a photograph that had been on file with the state for 6 years. We very quickly realized that was problematic for many reasons, including the fact that if you're trying to issue a one-time renewal for a real ID compliant license, 6 years, it doesn't equate to 8 years, which is pretty standard for a lot of our members. So we worked with Congress to remove that provision, and there is no cap on the photograph requirement for limitations around real ID. So that was a big win for us. I think it really opens up the field for really trying to improve the process. A couple of other things that were included in there included the fact that early in the process, the standalone provision that would have made real ID grants permanent was actually stricken from the bill through the committee process. So after the committee had marked up the bill, they had removed real ID grants altogether from the Modernization Act. But we did continue to press for the need for some sort of funding to accompany state efforts. And in that same omnibus, the 5,000-page bill that was passed over the holidays, there are references twice through the committee report of that bill, which say that both for the DHS appropriations language and the Federal Emergency Management Grant Program language in the bill, there is language that says those agencies should do what they can to assist state efforts towards real ID compliance. So it's good that it's referenced in some way and that there is some outlet for funding. We didn't get the need for direct real ID funding in specific language, but it's still there in the committee report language, which is important. I think we already talked about the political aspects of the removing of APA requirements for the regulatory process. Those three were the main things that were actually removed from the bill.
What about the conversation around address verification? I think there's been some uncertainty around where any changes with that landed.
Sure. Yes. So the initially, and the reason there's a little bit of confusion is the initial versions of the bill included address alongside the social security number, meaning that an applicant could come in and simply provide their address. It was not something that you needed to provide documentation of. And I think this was an effort by Congress to say, well, what's the low-hanging fruit on documentation and how necessary is that from a federal perspective, when most of the state members are central issuants and are mailing the document to that, shouldn't we leave it to the states for what's best for address verification? In the final stages of that bill, it was removed from the immediate relief measures that were inclusive alongside social security numbers. So address and social security number were initially coupled in the same way around immediate relief measures. But that's not to say that address relief is not still in the bill. It's my belief that address is still one of the components that are eligible for electronic or remote documentation submission. It's just not as visible as it was in early versions of the bill. So if you do a careful analysis, I think you'll see that the Real ID Modernization Act actually addresses all of the documentation that is needed to be presented for a Real ID credential. It will just take regulations to resolve some of the issues around address moving forward.
So it goes back to waiting for that rulemaking.
That's right, Ian.
You mentioned in some of the new pieces of the bill of some new mandates on the airline and travel industry, which is super fascinating because up till now, all of the Real ID laws and regulations have been very focused around what the states have to do and not do and what an applicant has to do and not do. Can you expand a bit on the requirements for airlines to do some education and notification and how prescriptive is it in terms of how they have to go about doing it?
Sure. So it really speaks to at the time of making a purchase. And this was something that was brought up early on. What are the best ways to educate the public about the Real ID program? What are the best touch points for consumer consumption of, you know, real ID program information. And it really ended up being that this is where both Congress and other stakeholders landed in terms of you don't want people going to the airport without their real ID credential after they've already purchased the ticket. So it makes sense to try and advise them that at time of purchase, you will need a real ID document in order to fly for, you know, all sorts of reasons. So while I don't think it describes exactly what you must do as an airline, the notification requirement at the time of purchase is a requirement. And I think it'll go a really long way in ensuring people understand before they get to the airport, they need to have the appropriate documentation in hand.
But it's a notification. It's not a, you have to put in your real ID information in order to be allowed to buy the ticket. It's more of a notification that to use this ticket to get on the airplane, you're going to need one of these acceptable forms of identification.
Yeah, the way I understand it is it would be more of a description of what the program is. Yeah. And what is acceptable. It doesn't state that you need a driver's license. It'll say these are acceptable forms of identification.
And is there a deadline that the airlines have to implement this by?
I would have to check, Ian, to be honest with you. I've looked more closely at the requirements around our state members than I have at the airline requirements.
And then I guess that brings us to kind of the last thing I really wanted to ask you about is in this acceptable forms of identification, a major update is the acceptance of a mobile credential to be Real ID compliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that that dovetails with a lot of work that extends, again, kind of both within and external to our community. There's a tremendous amount of work being done around MDLs and digital driver's licenses. I think that's one of the bigger lifts in the bill, is not only expanding the definition of what's acceptable, but how does that acceptability fit into the program and what state efforts have been to this point? So I think there's a lot of moving parts there, and it may end up being one of the more complex parts the bill addresses.
And perhaps one of the more complex parts of the rulemaking is I think that's where they'll be really outlining what makes an acceptable mobile driver's license for real ID purposes, right? So the law, the Modernization Act, opens up the door to use a mobile DL or a digital DL, digital identity. But the rulemaking is what's going to say, okay, what are the requirements of that mobile credential to be used for Real ID?
Absolutely. And I couldn't have said it any better. That's exactly right.
Well, I think we do know, you know, all from conversations we've all had offline that, you know, we've had very good conversations between our community and the Department of Homeland Security. They are very well aware of the work our members are doing. They're aware of the work AMVA's been doing on the international stage with ISO to build the MDL standard and the requirements for a MDL to be interoperable. And so I think it's fair to say all signs point that these things will coalesce and align as we go through the rulemaking and the implementation process.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd say, you know, there's also been efforts in that area that extend beyond just real ID acceptance, obviously. I think late in session, last legislative session, we saw a couple of bills being advanced that would really try and speak to furthering the need for a holistic digital and mobile driver's license or identity document process that goes beyond the driver's license community. So I think you'll see those efforts revamped in the next congressional session, where people are looking at the best way to prove identity in a holistic sense in the virtual and the digital space.
Well, it sounds like that will be the next time we'll be inviting you back to the AmbiCast once there's some legislation around digital identity and how that impacts our community.
Absolutely, and I can't wait.
Yeah. So, Sean, anything else about Real ID that we haven't talked about that needs to be on our listeners' radar?
I would just say that, you know, one of the points I will continue to reiterate is that while we continue to look at this from the Real ID lens and what it means for compliance with the program, I just really think that this is going to be one of those hallmark pieces of legislation that moves our community forward in terms of service, in terms of operations, that extend beyond Real ID. I do think we've learned a lot through the COVID pandemic. And I think that it may not be the last time where we have a need to service people in a different fashion than we have in the past. And I do think this goes a long way into addressing a lot of those requirements. So I'm very hopeful for what it presents. The only other thing I think that we have not touched on yet is the timeline for what we're looking at in terms of the Real ID program. As everything we're hearing from DHS is that the current Real ID program requirements will still go into effect in October of 2021. We realize a lot of this is impossible to be realized by then. So we're continuing to have conversations about whether that's a realistic expectation for the program. So,
and of course, the combination of the administration transition along with the unknown timeline of the pandemic, you know, may very well create new conversations around whether the administration wants to revisit that deadline or not.
Absolutely, Ian.
Well, Sean, I really appreciate you taking the time to come and chat with us today about Real ID. Also appreciate all the efforts that you and all of our partners have done to, you know, successfully get those improvements and efficiencies, made them reality in that omnibus bill, the new term that we've all learned about today. So, Sean, thanks again for joining us. I want to thank our producer, Claire Jeffrey, and I want to thank all of you for, again, tuning in to the AmvaCast. We'll see you next week, everybody. Stay well.
Thank you for joining us for AmvaCast, hosted by Ian Grossman, produced by Claire Jeffrey, music by Gibson Arthur. This episode was brought to you by Infosys Public Services. Visit us at amvacast.podbean.com and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify.